morning. My name is Teresa Coppers Nolan, the member.
Chair, I'm not members, and the distinguished guests, good morning. I am José Moedo Nongoyan, the member of this committee, which was the African National Congress for what the body should be.
Good morning, all. Kingston.
Good day, everybody. I'm José Moedo.
Did you buy plans?
Okay, I'll start that.
I'm Sean Manager, Parliamentary Liaison Officer for the Department of Science and Technology. Good morning, everyone.
Good morning, honorable members and colleagues. I'm Kafiso Mulena from the Office of the Deputy Minister.
Good morning, Honourable Chair and Honourable Members. I'm Martin Mulcahy, Special Advisor to the Minister.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and Honourable Members. My name is Luke Hilton. I'm Special Advisor to the Office.
Luke.
Now I give the opportunity for an overview of the our comments yesterday, so that the law advisor Barbara takes us through the bill and the changes they have instituted.
Thank you. I am taking a revised draft legal following the incident commission meeting, and this includes both the amendments as tabled by the department as well as the additional amendments proposed, the technical amendments that I think it's on the final page of the yesterday's document. The department prepared an analysis in some technical amendments, and then also some brief or there's some suggestions in here as following the point of clarity members raised, which you perhaps assist in giving some sort of some people need some of that to the provision. I am specifically asked to put this up because this is now the committee or the bill is now in the committee hands. Committee has the power to amend the bill or the clauses as committee members see fit. These are mere proposals. If members want me to quickly change something so that it's easy to see how the construction will look or how a change will fit in to a clause, that's the purpose why it's also up in society. So it's easy to shift and move things around to decide what the policy decision should prefer. I'm not going to go into what the department's policy rationale behind everything is. I think they're best easier to discuss that. Everything in red that members see here, if it is structurally in red, it was deleted in the bill as introduced, or if it's underlined, or it's just that is new insertion that the department has brought. In the first clause, then it speaks to amending the Scientific Research Council Act, and there it goes to the control over the management of the affairs of the council in clause 1. Following, I think the explanation that our colleagues in the department gave yesterday, the only thing that came up from them discussion was the role of the committee. What is the role of the committee when it comes to appointments, and how does the committee exercise its oversight mandate if there is no role assigned to it? And the senior department indicated that the idea of amending the second principles are to harmonize. We mentioned yesterday that there are four options four legal options for committee involvement. The one proposed by the department currently taking out all the official references to the National Assembly, that in itself is not illegal, it's not unsound. It merely leads parliament with a constitutionally assigned oversight mandate. So the committee will have to oversee the department with just its constitutional mandate. Then another option is the principal act that currently says the committee has a role when it comes to appoint making recommendations, neither making the committee the appointing authority, because that's again constitutional. But there's an option where it is possible for the committee to have a recommending role to play. That's what is currently in principle act, and that's what the department now seeks to remove to merely state the constitutional matter. Then there's options of that can be legislatively crafted into.
When members, because this is now our responsibility to oversee the finalization of this bill. When members, so when members feel that they have some question to ask them, or they want some clarification, they must point the shots so that the advisor can respond accordingly as she takes us through.
Thank you, Jadis, Chief Members, and this is your process. I'm here merely to assist.
Yes. Yeah, but let's say what, you know, on this point. Can you just draw my attention to the clause that is proposed must remove our oversight? So, it's close to
Honourable, it is throughout the bill, there's certain clauses, if I can find my matter the best example. Where it says that National Assembly instructs you there in this one, it is page 3 perhaps at the bottom, in South paragraph 3, member will see there, it says, the member of the board referred to, that's just in that context, must be appointed by the minister after consultation with the relevant committees of the National Assembly. That's the type of clause that's being removed generally, where it says that the minister must make appointments after consultation with the National Assembly. That does not alter the committee's constitutional mandate. Removing such a clause does not take an
opportunity. It is a red. We suggest it was an amendment that is proposed to this. As the blue one where they just remove. That's why I was terribly confused when they carried.
I wasn't clear. The blue proposals that we are making now as additional amendments to clarify, to give this, or from yesterday's discussions, to perhaps propose something that the committee may feel comfortable with. So the blue ones are new, they are not in the bill as tabled. They're open now for possible adjustments.
That's why I'm saying that they need to be informed as a committee when the minister appoints or dissolves the board. We need to be told within a specified time, which in this case is 30 days.
Thank you, members. I think Chair said it's actually a legal committee proposed amendment. It's not departing from a proposed amendment, but the view is committee possible proposal. And that then in a sort of
like... And our proposals are final, I do. That's what is going to be in the bill by local group, because it's our bill.
I took the question to mean something different. I took the question to mean, what is the logic of the deletion to the bottom of page 3 being in red? Because that suggests that is that's actually from the existing bill. The confusion is that it's in red. It's suggesting that it's something new.
No, I
understand that. So but normally in the bill you've got the existing and the new, and that's all there is. Here we've got three categories. We've got the new blue, we've got the original red, and we've got the underlying.
You're suggesting other members, and you can craft a different view if you want, but to have some sort of mechanism by which to empower the committee to exercise this constitutional oversight mandate, to give the committee some sort of avenue by which information is filtered to the committee when an appointment decision is taken. So to empower to then call on the minister and the department to explain something if the committee requires clarity. So our proposal, and this is roughly crafted, it can change, is the minister must report on any decision to appoint a member of the board, as well as confirm compliance with the appointment requirements to the National Assembly within 30 days. The compliance or reporting on the...
I like with 30 days. Is that
correct? Within 30 days.
It depends on our availability also. Depends on whether we, our program can accommodate it. We might be in recess and it eats up some of the time or the available for today. So don't you think we should be a little bit more flexible depending on the program or whatever?
I
understand.
Your views, because in legal, things that are used to teach a proper person. Now, to be, which is quite correct as well, excited about it, this new terminology, suitably skilled and qualified person. In that nomenclature, which is the best.
remember the phrase suitably qualified has been used in municipal statutes in the Local Government Municipal Systems Act. And there was one matter, you were talking about whether there were any precedents. I remember there was one matter involving a Mabasa versus a local government municipality about how they ran to court to instigate the appointment of him as a municipal manager. And I think it hinged on the basis of whether the person in question was suitably qualified. That might shed light on that. But I mean, I agree, usually for offices that are legal related for independent purposes, they have that fit and proper. But then in other administrative organizations, like that local government, they use suitably qualified to written into law. That's my answer.
I also need some guidance regarding the meaning of words, and perhaps Honourable Smith can help in the legal advisers. Does suitably skilled and qualified also include experience? Do we need a CEO to have experience? Is it included in that wording? I don't think so.
You have to see this in the context of the appointment that's being asked for. Special purpose, just glancing at the bill now, I would think things like earlier that if you're involved and could not run something special proper, if you are declared mentally ill, like what it was, and then you won't be special proper, that goes more to the person, can you function logically, can you apply yourself to the position. The suitably skilled and qualified person, I would read in the context of what qualifications somebody on this board require to assist the body or the entity which this board should be running. So suitably skilled, that can perhaps go to how much experience do you have, how skilled are you, that kind of formal qualification. So it doesn't go to here. So if you want somebody that you need to be appointed in a legal position, a suitably skilled person would have an LLB. That's a skill level. But a suitably qualified person would be the LLB. Suitably skilled person, depending if it's a senior manager position for the legal advisor, that person would have to have a certain years of management experience along with that. So that's where you see your skills are in the context of that is looking at your experience, what are your qualifications, do you have the base understanding of what the job requires. But that to me is context specific and different from fit and proper, but that is the person in general.
Okay.
That's my interpretation, my colleague.
If I can just add to you, Chair, our understanding in using the term qualified is in a broader context, that it's not only the qualification in terms of certificate stuff, but broadly in encompassing also the skills, the experience, you know, which makes a person qualified in a position.
The only reason why I ask this question is because it's law. And what is the English for weg uitleg? Interpretation of rules. So it's important because it might land in court, end up in court, and then we need to be specific when it comes to using certain terms. That's the reason for my question. Thank you.
Yeah. We're getting a briefing on the amendments. We touched only on the issue of Parliament's role. I was taking it that was simply a briefing of a proposal, but we'll have a substantive discussion of the merit of it at some point. But we haven't done so yet. And I just want to check with you if that's the case. Maybe we should rather come in now. So we'll handle that later.
So I'll
stand by.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. All right.
Which is a challenge. Now, I had something on the first page. Can I deal with it later? I just want to understand your question.
No. Because we are taking us through, it is then the honor is now upon us.
Okay.
That is what we want to do. We are all in our case of the question.
Below section 280, the A, publish a notice in the Gazette and two national newspapers.
Why is that?
It's on the first page.
First page?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just below subsection 2A, the old subsection 2A, the A, B,
yeah.
Is, and two national newspapers. I would like to suggest or ask, can't we be more specific when it comes to languages? And do we have to make dead sure that it is in line with the New Language Act? Because if it's only in one language, then I think it won't be in line with the Language Act. I made a similar remark in the past, and the department responded positively to my remarks when it comes to advertisements in newspapers. So we cannot only have it in one language according to my understanding.
Languages Act, that the act that was drafted on specifically speaks to national departments and how they interact with the society's own language. I think at the end were three or four languages that was decided on, which is higher than the constitutional standard set in section 2 or section 6 of the constitution. But it can be crafted in for purposes of complying then to say that they're seeing that this is an entity I'll have the departments will have to jump in here. That you can say just to keep that almost in line with how the entities will be then as departments with them publishing, seeing as the ministers publishing on behalf of the entity that comes in line with the Youth Languages Act. Can we put in a reference here? Would you see? I don't see anything legally wrong with the bank being there is this obligation to say that these are classes.
We think that it can be done. We can adjust it to indicate that it has to be done. Yes.
So, thank you, sir. How are you going to?
Chair, we're going to make reference to the Language Act so that any publication will be consistent with the requirements of the Language Act. Which effectively I think it brought it out to say, you know, it doesn't have to be English only, but it has to be, because if it's in a province, then it has to be in province English and the language that is predominant in the province or language that are predominant. But nationally, we'd have to get guidance from the Language Act how to deal with it.
So in other words, that cannot be said to be too national. Because to me, it is substantial that the cost. For this thing. So I wanted a clarity from you.
Perhaps maybe we will discuss with the parliamentary advisors for how to deal with such that it satisfies the requirements of accessibility whilst also not being a drain on state of social climate.
I would just like to remind the members and the members of the department, yesterday was specifically more than once it was referred to the fact that there was not proper response from the public on advertisements. And I think it might also be because of language constraints that it was only advertising in one language. So that's another reason behind my question.
Can I raise another one, page 1 as well then? Just be going to that minute. Yeah, I find the wording of the clause 8 of Boston somewhat strange, but maybe it's just leading rather pedantic. It says here, a member of the board must vacate his or her office if he or she resigns. Well, in fact, it's five reasons. The third, fourth, and fifth make perfect sense to me. Or third, yeah. But the first one that doesn't make sense, the A and B don't make sense, because if you resign, you have vacated office already. You have vacated. The mere act of resigning is you vacated office. If the minister fires you, you have vacated your office, I think, at least. Because if it says you have vacated office if you resign, that suggests vacating office is not the position you hold, but the room.
because, I mean, the word office is ambiguous, right? So office is the position you hold, and it's the place where you work. So if you say you vacate office when you resign, must do so, that suggests that there's something that has to happen after you've resigned. And the only thing that's left for you to do is to move out of your office. So this is then talking about the office that you work from, or it's talking about the position you hold. So to me, A and B both refer to position. Therefore, it happens automatically. You have to take the office. You've lost your office by virtue of resigning. You can't say you must vacate having resigned. I think A and B are tautologous or something, and they just don't fit there. C, D, and E make sense, because there is as a consequence of something else, where you then have to vacate office by virtue of something that happened. But I don't understand resignation or being fired.
And the response from...
Which might say if I die, I must vacate office. No, it's depending on if I die.
And the response?
Chair, we need to review the wedding here. We may probably... say instead of saying the member of the board about his office, to say ceases to be a member of the board if he or she resigned or his or her nomination is terminated. So we will have to look at the wording so that it doesn't lead to much ambiguity. That's what I'm saying.
On page 2, 9A. Edition, believe, underlined edition, 9A, the first line, may appoint any person. Could you give us some more clarity on any person? Is that without advertising? Who then is any person?
Follow the laws.
Have you worked with this document?
Oh, it'll help. Okay, I'll just read from the part.
That you should have qualified skills.
number three, and shall be eligible for reappointment. Now, is that then eligible for reappointment on page two? The bottom of the page, number three. I'm working on yesterday's document. Oh well, my notes are on yesterday, but it's the same source to you. Just take your source feeding. Shall be edited on page feeding under 10. So 10, number 3, shall be eligible for reappointment. Now, the original act reads not more than 5 years and shall be eligible for reappointment. Is that then for the next term?
Yeah.
And they can only serve 2 terms. Now, I'm going to ask this question because it applies to other instances in the document as well. Is it possible for someone to be appointed for two consecutive terms, but then the third term not being a member, and then possibly for a fourth term or later on in Felicia's first board? Is it possible to come back for a third term, but not consecutive?
Chair, this clause relates to the CEO, not the member of the board. So I understand Honorable Governor's question is in relation to the member of the board, whether the member can serve for 2 consecutive terms and then can be reappointed again, but not in a consecutive sequence. To me, I think that is possible because the act only says that you can be appointed only for 2 consecutive terms, but it doesn't say that you cannot be appointed again so long as there has been a break in the appointment process. But relating to clause 10 in relation to the chief executive officer, the act currently was silent on whether the chairperson, the CEO, can be reappointed after the expiry of his or her first 5-year term. So we needed to insert this provision so as to to be clear, to remove any possible ambiguity that they may probably only serve 1 term, to be clear that they can be reappointed again. But practically it's been happening, but to make sure that there is no confusion or any legal issue that arises because the act is not specific in this time.
But still, I think the question is still very whether it's even if it is the CEO, after serving the 2 consecutive terms, is not that it's supposed to be that term. But then the later state is really eligible to come back again.
If I could, just on the reading of it, this doesn't limit to 2 terms. This is limits to a period of appointment of 5 years. Maybe reappointed again on the decision of the board. The CEO is not limited to 2 terms. There's no reading in this that limits it.
But we're talking here about any appointment, even for other members, whether they after serving 2 terms, consecutive 2 terms, they are still eligible after if it's not consecutive terms, after the 2 terms of office.
Sorry, Chair, this clause 3 that Honourable Clopper's Lowlands is referring to is specifically with reference to the Chief Executive Officer.
Chief, you will remember I mentioned when I started asking my question the same kind of question applies to other instances in the document. I specifically said it comes up now and I need clarity and I accept your explanation, but that it also applies this question to other positions. And can you understood me? Thank you.
I don't think the position of the CEO is all that the same. So whether one chooses to restrict the term of office of one doesn't mean that it should necessarily invite the other. So I personally have no problem with the CEO having indeterminate terms, like the CEO of the department. I mean, nobody says that the DG has to go after 5 years or 10 years he has to go. No. The CEO remains as long as he or she performs the job to the satisfaction of the board. So I don't have a problem there. The issue on board members is separate, and there I agree with the issue here. It's a policy issue of whether it's good to restrict it or not. But here I have no problem with this wording.
Chair, the currently the legislation provides for two candidates and which is the initial appointment and a reappointment for one more term. And it doesn't go further to say if there has been a break, whether the person can be considered again for a fresh appointment. We have to look at some sort of guidance, because I know that there are a DPSA document relating to the appointment of board members. Whether it is, my reading of it is like it was silent on that, but we have to get guidance or to get guidance in terms of whether we need to pronounce on put a provision in the legislation indicating that, or we will have to be guided by the opposition.
That's not the number one thing about that. Therefore, you must today welcome that, because it seems that we do not want to have a silent document. What we have of what we have
and the
only one after some time to find that there were gaps in the act.
Does raise a question which also whether the wording creates a slight ambiguity too, because if you say that the person shall be eligible for reappointment, one's automatic reading is at the conclusion of the first 5 years, eligible for reappointment means for the next immediate, so you get two consecutive 5-year periods. But it doesn't have to be read that way. I mean, I would assume it means that, but it could just as well mean you serve 5 years now, and in 15 years' time, when it comes back again, are you eligible for reappointment at that time? Which is literally a sense. This is meant to mean any reappointment. Because a reappointment doesn't have to mean on conclusion of your current term, it can be a reappointment after a gap. So, maybe.
Just possibly if we take it back to page 1 on the book of names, because there's a section under this, the Principal Act, the Scientific Research Council Act, under section 3 and 3A, speaks to this matter. A member of the board, excluding the chief executive, shall hold office for a period not exceeding 4 years, but shall be eligible for reappointment. 3A says, save as provided for in subsection 3, no member may serve more than 2 consecutive terms. Consecutive terms. Mm. By implication, it means that they're not consecutive.
Then you can.
No problem. So that's how I would read it. I mean, if a person has served 2 terms and then takes a break and comes back. It's not a consecutive term. The law advisors possibly
to carry out. That's the idea I'm saying.
Judge Murphy, I agree with that interpretation. It's not consecutive, and the act criteria has specific meaning to the benefiting by the court that should be allowed. If that's not for the name one, then we'll have to cross that difference because consecutive just means of following one another. It's right, no longer consecutive, and we appoint and can't follow.
Okay, I agree. Right. So we leave the entities, it's fine, but you reduce the entities. It's understood what it means. Yeah. Okay.
Should just for a reply to it, do I now continue where you left off? Can I jump back to? Or is there anything else the members wanted to raise in that section?
We all know.
As in clause 3, and yet it's still there in clause 4,
Then, in clause 4, we say it must represent broad scientific disciplines, but in clause 3, it's all about technology. It's not broad scientific disciplines, it's technology only, it's the only focus. So I'm not sure that clause 3 and 4, A, speak to each other, and B, speak to the nature of the body.
Thanks, yeah. Clause 3, in our understanding, relates to the achievement of distinction, basically the skill in these fields, which is research and technology.
Yes.
Research and technology and technology management. Business and public affairs.
Yes.
But we remove civil society because one can not have skill in civil society, so it was not making sense.
No, it's distinction in the field of, doesn't say skill. You could be a civic activist who's achieved distinction. It's not a skill, but it's still having achieved distinction. The way I read it.
To us, it felt like public affairs and civil society in this context relates to one and the same thing. So we needed to remove one and retain one. And perhaps maybe we remove the civil society when we could have removed public affairs, but it does not make sense if you retain both.
Even three and four should say the same thing there. Four you've kept civil society, and three you've got public affairs. Why not make them
we can instead of removing civil society, delete public affairs and retain civil society, so that you can understand in terms of use of technology.
And the main issue, that's not the main issue. The main issue is research, the fields of research, or just
Chair, if I may comment. I take the points that Honourable Smith is raising, and I think there would be no problem in putting in a comment and saying the fields of research, technology management, because they're not the same thing. Research and technology are quite clearly limits, because many of our top researchers are not involved in the field of technology. They're pure fundamental research.
Well, Chair, if they do go that route, then surely instead of just saying research, say scientific research. Because we're not talking about the soft sciences, we're not talking about sociology and urban planning, we're talking about science here, aren't we?
The NRF has a responsibility for this, human and social sciences as well. We do give significant funding and so on.
And also
HSS
too.
I think
more the HSS too.
Yes.
I was also worried about the combination of research and technology. I think we must split it, because research and technology, to me, doesn't make any sense. The research alone and technology alone doesn't make sense.
If I may raise another issue, I know it's a problematic one, because this is not specific to this department.
Can you on this point of research and technology, that we make a comma there instead of making it as one thing.
Chair, my understanding is that we're going to change it to read like activities in the field of research, comma, technology, and technology management.
We're keeping public affairs or civic affairs.
We'll delete public affairs and keep civil society with understanding in terms of use of technology.
The Chair, the other idea is it's common in many books, not simply for acts. And this is this clause 9, which is a quite problem. You know, when we have a senior member of our government goes over to America and can't get to immigration because he's considered a terrorist, right? And we have a clause effectively which denies people like him the opportunity to serve on board if we're an American country. We're an American now, and we had this in front of us, right? Half of our government, half our ministers are prohibited from serving on boards because they've been deemed to have completed a provision of this nature, almost. You know what I mean? And I wonder, is interested in. I'm just wondering whether the wording cannot reflect the notion that it's certain types of behaviors that are being sanctioned here. Not, I mean, if civil rights happens in Burma, you know, then you'd be locked up for 6 months, 20 years in house arrest. You get a Nobel Prize, Peace Prize, but you can't serve on a board here because you're considered to be criminal. That kind of wording, this doesn't allow for. And
no, actually, the good example is what has happened to former Minister of Justice in the United States. He was, because he was listed as a terrorist. Yeah. And then he gave us
law. That's the example I'm talking about. But also, you know, the need of Burma. Yeah. Opposition here. I mean, lots of examples. You know, activists in China, all the activists in China, you know, who are locked up all the time, would be considered democratic members here.
I think we must think about that, we must think about how to work that, and it converges with the content of the member state. And from experience that we have, it's a skills federation.
If I bring it closer to home, Jay, you could be a comment, and I think that the Kenyan activist, the MP and activist who's locked up, the one with all the trees, was it coming in? Sorry, there's a name coming up, I can't hear it. But I mean, the point is, you know, a person like that, specifically in fact when you're making provisions for persons within the continent to serve on boards, you know, you do make specific provisions, certain a person like that could easily be an activist somewhere who's been locked up and who is, you know, now okay, back here they've been, you know, denied it.
So Professor Gordon, the constitutional expert, he was an activist in Kenya, so he's a person who fled Kenya.
Yeah.
So he thinks he can't serve on the board.
If he's locked up.
Where is that?
Nine.
When?
It says, when you committed an offence in the Republic or elsewhere and sentenced to imprisonment without a criminal fine.
Convicted here?
Yes.
What's wrong with that?
So you're a human rights activist and you're locked up.
You won't be locked up.
No.
Okay. Let's come in.
Chair, I think it has to be read in conjunction with the rest of it. The person may not be appointed a member of the board if that person is not a citizen or permanent resident of the Republic.
Yeah.
And in the period post-94, the introduction of the Constitution anyway, has been convicted of an offence.
Yeah.
So if the person has been given permanent residence, that would have been vetted already.
I'm talking specifically about permanent residence. Somebody's come in from elsewhere, who's a permanent resident, but elsewhere had been locked up somewhere for civil rights activism or something. We would say you are disqualified to be considered. That's the way I view it. It's just a concern. It doesn't matter if anybody's right. It doesn't have to. There's plenty of candidates for the court. I was just saying, why are you excluding people who might have been very good people?
Okay, response.
Rule of law.
Thanks. The suggestion that I'll put on the table to Honorable Smith, give it comfort, is perhaps if we qualify this to say if they've been convicted of an offence, something like involving dishonesty, fraud, and have a group of crimes, you know, the lifetimes that we want to exclude people from board membership on, other than just broad economic terms, which may also, you know, capture the people that may have been convicted of being, you know, extremists.
I think you must phrase it as for offense other than political problem. Yeah. Then you such a then remove the political context.
I'm not sure what grounds we're on here because it's other than political in terms of whose determination of political. So if I'm convicted of terrorism because I'm a member of Al-Qaeda, is that a political offence?
Yeah.
but I can still serve on a board.
But we've also
got
refugees in this country,
those
political refugees.
No, I don't dispute that point, Honourable Smith, but the question really is that this is really operating in terms of a rule of law. The person has been convicted in a country that is legitimately constituted, etc.
Doesn't it legitimately constituted?
No, it doesn't, but the implication is.
Right. Any country, Somalia, not
Scotland.
That's
the question. I have no idea what the legislators will have to decide.
Check. For me, the criteria are really very objective. You are convicted and you are sentenced to a term of imprisonment. Would you take that person to serve in the court to maintain the image of that court? Once you do that. I hear the argument, but to me, it looks like in those circumstances, it's not the person that is convicted here.
Clauses that deal with appointment and your disqualification. The
instead of saying convicted of an offense, it usually stipulates one type of crime. If it's somebody that deals with financial matters, it will say committed of fraud, corruption, because that affects your skill level and your competence to be able to serve on the board. So members are correct that you can't serve on the board if you're not a citizen or a permanent resident. But this is these are also not very selectively, there's an all, so you can look at the qualifications separately. So if automatically if you're not a citizen or a permanent resident, you can't serve, that's your qualification. But there might be minor crimes as well, overseas that somebody can be held or can be convicted for. I just mentioned to you quite a few jaywalking. Strictly speaking, if you're in Finland, they obviously respect you. If you cross the road and the road is not green to you, they look at you almost like they want you to be arrested. But these are small petty crimes, and we're just saying you've been convicted of an offence. Perhaps if we can come to the committee with an example of a standard example almost of a board appointment where they say specific crimes and of a specific serious nature that will impact, will that resolve the concern?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Back to this. Let me confuse myself better maybe. In terms of law or the legal process, you get, if you have committed a crime in another country, go to another country, can you be regarded, say after a certain period, can you be given residential or what, citizen permit, even if you have committed a crime somewhere? So it means that the vetting doesn't work. The issue, why should people be vetted to check if they haven't committed any sort of crime before they leave their country? I'm asking this as a lay person now.
There are good crimes and bad crimes. Right? You can be a Greenpeace activist, like the Russians now, were arrested all these Greenpeace activists in the Arctic Ocean. They haven't let them go because of international pressure. So they're going to be charged with treason and locked up because they were protesting against oil exploration in the Arctic. Now, you can't call that a crime in the same sense like going to my mother or something, so like a baby in a hole. That's not the same thing. That's activism. You've got people who oppose Japanese whalers, and if they're in Japanese waters, they get arrested. That's not the same thing as a crime, what we're talking about here. But this way it's worded encompasses everything. And I'm saying, and the Lord writes, you can word it so it covers appropriate offences and not inappropriate offences. That's all I'm saying.
One of the dangers with trying to enumerate a series of specific offences is that you might miss one. That's one of the dangers. Another one is it might be recognised in South Africa and in Finland, but how are we going to make sure that it's recognised in all the different jurisdictions? And it becomes a pragmatic nightmare to try to make sure you get everything in. That's the concern.
Can't we often put this wording just in case we can?
Chair, can I suggest that we adopt the wording that is in the National Scientific Provisions Act, which qualifies the offence? It says that after the Commission of Constitution has been convicted of a crime specified in Schedule 1 to the Criminal Procedure Act 1977, which is for the list of those, other than listing them, but we refer to the Schedule 1, which is like your murder, corruption, fraud, all those, you know, high crimes, which, you know, is.
It's jaywalking and speeding.
Actually, in fact, by law, you cannot list explosives that exist in other laws. That's a topic is correct in the constitutional. But if we're dealing with, I remember we're dealing with other legislation where they are saying that we cannot deal with this
a very good example, in fact, in this country is debt. A few years ago, you could be sent to jail for debt. Right? That was prohibited. I remember in 1996 or 1997, we passed a law to prohibit being in jail for debt.
Until then, you could be. Now, that would be an example of something that's inappropriate. Well, maybe it's appropriate, actually, but you know what I mean? Things which are not necessarily linked to functionality of your job.
May I ask a question or two on verse 4? You also have the 2A, the new 2A, again the national newspaper for languages. I just want to remind you of that. Then on the 2B, I didn't notice call upon the National Advisory Council and the Council of Higher Education to nominate persons contemplated in subsection 1A3. Does that mean the National Advisory Council nominates one and the Council for Higher Education nominates one? I just want to understand this one. I'm not sure. Have a look at 1-3. Two other members nominated by the National Advisory Council. So is it one by the council and one by the CHE?
So
or do they agree that they... I just want to have clarity on that.
Okay, let's ask questions to add to that. Is you asking whether the reference should be subsection 2 and 3 as opposed to 1 and 2? Is that the question? That I understand. It says 2 and 3.
No.
Let me see 1 and 2.
As I understand, Chair, sorry. Is that
2 and 3?
The call upon the National Advisory Council on the innovation and Council of Education to nominate persons for the president of the 1A3 above, which are the two people. And to me, logic would suggest that each and it's 1-1, but the question she's asking, is it clear enough so that there's no conflict between these two entities, that one is decided to 1 and the other one is decided to 1, so then they will two together. And if they disagree, what would we do?
We can go back to 2B, and I'll read 2B. By written notice, call upon the National Advisory Council and the Council for Higher Education to nominate persons contemplated in subsection 1A3. Now let's read 1A3. Two other members nominated by the National Advisory Council of Innovation and the Council of Higher Education and appointed by the Minister. Now my question is, does NAAQI nominate one and the Council for Higher Education nominate one, or as the Honourable Member explained, or can both of them nominate two, and then what happens if they are in disagreement?
Thanks, Chair. The intention is that each one nominate one, but to be clear in the amendment, perhaps I would suggest that we say two other members each nominated by the National Advisors, if that will clarify that each one nominates one, or any other formulation that will, you know, remove the potential ambiguity.
Thank you, Chair. From considering from the interpretation point of view, perhaps if I can play devil's advocate for a moment, you have the Minister the appointing authority. So therefore you're calling for nominations to give the Minister a pool from whom or from which to choose. If you say, I read that as two other members nominated by those two entities, from their nominations the Minister has the appointing authority must appoint and choose. But if each of them only nominate one and you give those two names to the minister, you're basically telling the minister against your two. I feel that as they can nominate with two each or three, it's a call for nomination. But from those nominations received, the minister can only appoint two. That's how I read the interpretation.
They can nominate 10. You think it's too often, it doesn't really matter how many.
Persons. Nominate persons.
I understand the argument of that opera, yes, and I think I saw you nodding, so which means that you have something else to offer.
Thanks, Chair. I'm subject to correction here, perhaps maybe Martin can correct me, but my understanding is that the entities are approached to give the minister the name of the person that they will have decided that will represent that entity in this entity. So now he will be approached to say provide the minister with the name of the person that should be appointed by the minister to represent NACI in the NRL. So the minister will not be given more than one name. He will be given the name that the entity will have through its own internal processes have come up with to say this is the person that we think should be in the NRL to represent the entity. So the understanding is that it's only one name. Each of these institutions will give the minister one name each of the person of the people that should be appointed to represent this institution.
Yeah. Could I suggest a possible wording? If we were to say that two other members to be appointed by the minister after nominations have been received from the National Council of Innovation and the Council on Higher Education. After nominations have been received. That's satisfying.
Does that answer the process as I read it here is that they nominate two people and those two people whom they choose to nominate are automatically members and then they have to appoint them. Although they don't appoint, they don't nominate six and the minister chooses two. They nominate two and they appoint, the process of appointment is a formality and the minister has to appoint them. In other words, they have a right to nominate their representatives as they see them on there, not provide a shortlist. So the wording, if that's what the intention is, then the wording should reflect that, as opposed to giving the sense that the minister selects from nominees. So he doesn't select from nominees. He appoints those that they have nominated, the way I read this.
Now, the wording is not clear.
Chair, yes, definitely those are the two options. I think the law advisor has indicated that the thrust of this is that the minister appoints the board. It would be quite strange to then suggest that NACI will appoint a board member and the CHE will appoint a board member. So the proposal I had put for consideration is that each of these entities will nominate members or people to be selected by the minister. So it really puts the onus back on the minister, that ultimately the minister is accountable for everybody on the board.
It's obviously a policy issue.
Yeah.
The question is what was intended in the first instance by the department. So it's not clear what the department intended. But the notion that a body can't appoint a member to the board is false. Because, one of the other ones here, I can't remember what it is, the departments appoint scientists. Remember the clause 9 we discussed earlier, they appoint somebody to serve. That's from a department. They don't provide a shortlist, which will then select. They appoint somebody as a department to serve on the board. I can't remember which one it was. We're coming back. Coming later on. So they can do that. It is practice. It's not automatic. And there are many professional boards, of course, where the minister appoints like 60% and the profession might appoint 40% of the board.
Do they then hold the minister accountable? I didn't know he didn't appoint the, he had a choice to appoint. It doesn't seem fair to hold the minister accountable when he hasn't had a choice in this bigger pool than steps on the previous time.
That's an entitlement is more effective. Because it can not only the minister responsible if the minister did not appoint it should be the choice of the minister to appoint the minister who must get the nominees and then the minister choose for the nominees and not those
institutions. Could it not be written into the law to say that the nominee plus one or one more nominee than the position required so that it's clear that the minister must make a choice if that's the policy.
Okay, I think Martin has put it correctly. That clause of Martin was correct that the Vasari gives the minister a choice to appoint. I think if we can incorporate the clause that the Martin talked about, then I think we'll be safe. Are we agreed?
Yes. Good. Yeah.
What's the question? The yesterday when we were discussing the...
I was still on this.
The Natural Scientific Professions Act, the amendment.
Does not feel that a nomination by Director General, whoever, or NACI is appropriate, the Minister will not appoint and send it back and say, send me another nomination. That should be in the discretion of the Minister. But the Minister is still responsible for appointing a nominated person by that particular entity. I'm not sure if that's...
That really might be useful.
Perhaps from an employment law perspective, for example, if you as an employer call for, you do a call for advertisement and you get the CVs in, if you're not happy with the batch of CVs you receive, you simply do another call, you scratch that process and you start over. I think that's what Martin's trying to explain. It's basically this call for nominations is the minister's call for advertisements for CVs. And if the CVs can come in and he's not happy with it, you'll tell them that this is I'm rerunning the process, these kinds of unfeasible. You can correct me if I'm wrong, but that's more or less the analogy that I've seen.
Yes and no, Chair. I think I'm also picking up the Honourable Smith's points that refers to the SACNAS, where a nomination is by the Director General of particular parties. And that's a nomination. But the argument I was making was that nomination still has to be appointed by the Minister. If the Minister, in the Minister's discretion, feels that's not an appropriate appointment, then the Minister goes back to the DG and says, send me another nomination. This person is not qualified and possibly for the following reasons. Or doesn't even have to give reasons, but the appointment is for the Minister's appointment. and therefore that the minister still remains accountable to Parliament.
Okay. That's completely agreeable. I mean, the policy level makes no sense. But it still goes back to the issue there, is whether they, just for clarity, whether the nominees here constitute a shortlist from which two people are appointed, or whether they appoint two. I mean, even if it doesn't matter which way it is, we ought to at least be clear what we mean. It may not have any effect, but you can't leave it ambiguous simply because it's on it's part of the policy.
And lastly, how can we say the act?
Minister, sorry, I'm not chair. I'm talking too much about ministers at the moment. Possibly that clause 3, the one that Honourable Clotilde Lawrence has raised, could be rephrased to say that two other members to be appointed by the minister after nominations have been received from those two entities.
Yeah. And it could be two or more.
Yes. And if they want to give more than two nominations, that's fine. If they send one nomination, that's okay. It doesn't pin it down too much.
On the same level and according to the same requirements, as I understood. So, and it applies to another case as well. I would suggest that we include the word independent panel, as is stated in the CSIR Act. It's on page 1, just below 2A. B, appoint an independent panel, as opposed to panel. So in other words, it's a change, suggested change to the bill, to include the word independent. And it applies to another instance or two later on. G, it's on page 3, clause 4, 2C. But it starts off with wording from the original act and appoint a panel. Now, if you go to the CSIR Act, they refer to an independent panel. And all I'm asking is, seeing that we are standardizing and we want the same requirements, I would like to suggest that include the word independence, but it applies to another instance or two later on in this document.
Chair, the suggestion is
successful. Also, I think it's just a reference. I may have, I just want to carry that out and misunderstand it. In 2A, in same page 2A, so it says here, for the purpose of appointing a member of the board, referred to in subsection 1A, which is above us, the minister must A, publish blah 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 blah, to nominate persons contemplated in subsection 1 and 2. What is subsection 1, 1 and 2? Because which persons would they... they're not the persons being referred to above in 1A, are they? But then it should be 1A, 1 and 2.
Yeah.
So is it 1A, 1 and 2, or is it 1, 1 and 2? I think this, the reference is wrong.
Yeah.
I suspect it's wrong. And then, if it's wrong, my question would be... okay, well, that's fair enough. That is just a reference. I was going to say, I would have thought sub 2 was all that's required, but I can see you might want sub 1 as well, which is other than the other members. So, yeah, so I think it should be subsection 1A, 1 and 2.
1A and 1 and 2.
Excuse me, also the A shouldn't be
there.
Yeah, it's
a
sub.
Sub
Well, the S stands for
But this amendment will go to
resolved in a useful sense, but after you send it again, they will see that as well as be reflected as a decision made.
There is another issue. I mean, it goes back to the fact that we're trying to harmonize processes and procedures, and I would think in harmonizing the way we deal with various boards, we would also harmonize the language we use to fit the amendments. Now, a large part of the amendments that we've put forward are harmonized in the sense of identical wording, which is appropriate, I think, if we're trying to do that. But if you take, for example, we on clause 6 now, we're on page 5, eh? Clause 6, now look at 4A and B. That's the provision here basically is unended. But if you go to page 3 and you look at the 4 there, it's also the same provision, but it's worded differently. So it's a 4 only instead of a 4 A and B, plus it has different provisions in it as opposed to the 4 here. Now, on page 3, the 4 there referring to the CSIR also allows for an acting CEO appointed from a staff member, but it's subject to conditions of payment, remuneration, allowances as being determined, etc., which are not provided for here in 4A. So I would think if we're going to harmonize a provision like 4 in principle, we should harmonize the way it's worded for all of these bodies. So the principle is correct, obviously, and this is not an amendment on the table, so I'm just proposing another amendment. It's obviously correct that we have a provision to deal with an acting CEO. But the manner in which the acting CEO issue is regulated should be the same for all of them. Here it's not the same. So I'm just proposing that we regularize the equivalent of the clause 4 for all of these bodies. And the second question then arises whether you have the equivalent of section 4 for all of them. Now some of them you can see simply because it's here, and I'm unfortunately not walking around with the principal acts for all of these bodies, so I can't comment. But just to the department, I would assume that your 4A, the provision, is common for all of these structures. Maybe just to quickly check that it is, and it is not really for those that it doesn't make the difference. Is that clear? Maybe I'm being very wordy. You got what I'm saying? Yeah? Cool. Yeah.
Just from
Peggy,
and then just as a point of clarity from a drafting perspective, members would like to see this change being effective throughout the provisions of this of the board stands now. That we can do. The suggestion is just if we have to go look at the principal act of all and then think other changes, we're walking into the danger zone that I explained yesterday of having to ask the National Assembly now for permission to make changes to the principal act of clauses that aren't open for amendments right now. It's just the committee back just a few weeks procedure wise. It's not that the committee can't do so, it's just we need to then go through that procedure as well.
Could we just get clarity on that process? Because I mean, I've been doing this for 1,000 years and I've never had a hiccup where we can't amend another clause. I've never had a procedure where we, in amending an act, we can't affect another provision unless it's a substantive thing where public consultation is required. So if it affects the tenor of the act and there's an obligation for public consultation and inputs, then it could be construed that we have to take it through another process because they need to be able to comment on those changes. Maybe. But I mean, this was just sort of simply tidying up the language of the existing provision. Surely you're not suggesting that you are required to get permission for a comma somewhere, for example, like we had earlier, research and technology, now we're putting research, comma, technology, new, it's the same principle. Or you're just tidying up the language.
I just clarify. I'm not saying there can't be technical amendments, but it's more just that the rule that's currently stated, just the bill is introduced by the department. This is not a committee bill. The committee now has the power to and the competency to change the clauses that have been opened by the department. It's more that if we go, if all the these subsection 4 related or similar clauses, all of them aren't listed in the bill as currently before the committee. We have to go look for them in the principal act and they're 7. And so that might be in clause 2 or 1 act, but that clause 2 has not been dragged into the bill. And it's for that purpose, we just need to list the National Assembly that the committee has identified this need. And then that gives the committee the power to drag that clause into this bill because it's not a committee bill, it's a department decided for. So we're kind of in merging the two, putting a committee amendment in with that. It's not just can't be done,
there's a procedure to elect the House.
Yes, so we don't need permission.
Well, it's you see consent by reporting. And that's, I don't have the rules, I don't know, but, you know, perhaps that's the rules, but you, we need, it's a discretion whether the committee wants to do it or not, but once that discretion is exercised, the committee needs to elect the House. As an extension of the House, you can't need permission from the House, because you're acting on behalf of, as a representative of the other members in the House. It's a very technical question.
Is that rule being introduced recently?
I think it's been here for a while. Committees have just been exercising more of their legislative, I want to say muscle, recently in looking beyond what has been introduced and going into the Political Act more thoroughly. So I think it's because committees that have been actively legislating with this rule have come to light more.
If an issue is quite a principle, if we have a closed pool and we are harmonising, the question is why don't we harmonise it? So here, for example, you appoint an acting CEO, you do it subject to certain conditions, remuneration, etc., for CSIR, but we don't do it here. Is there not merit in making it a standard provision? That's my question.
That it was derived from the principal act, then why can't it be used for another section? Why would we need to go to the National Assembly because it's already there?
No, it's not there as an amendment, just here as a principal act. It's not an amendment. It's in our document simply because it's part of the text. But it's not an amendment, that's the part of the proposal.
No, what I'm saying. Yeah, sorry. What I'm saying, to seek permission from the National Assembly, why would we? Because it's already there. We have used it in another section.
Just our procedure, that process doesn't have to be so long. We can already, if you decide today that there needs to be the route that we're taking, we're touching now and track that up before us here in the role that came. We can alert the assembly when it's the next session, we get that permission, and by the time we get that permission, our process isn't concluded, so we can preempt it. We say that they are stuck now, that we are looking at that last year, so they give us that permission that we can broaden the scope, and by the time we finalize, we have that permission. It doesn't have to be when we finalize, we say there's three things that, you know, we need permission on. We can do it now.
What I think I'm understanding from Honorable Smith is that he is saying that if we are harmonized, we have the second section in what has come before us, which says that subject to remuneration, which has already been used in another section. Mm-hmm. Why can't we use it right throughout? Because it is why do you have seek permission from the National Assembly, but use it in another entity here. What we are saying that it must be used for all such appointments.
Because they're saying they didn't propose it, because we have to do it.
Before then. I've just heard. I understand. But then in terms of the procedure, that we want therefore to consider other processes that are not in table format. We need it to have that money. I understand that. The question why I wanted to come before them is, if we do that, will that not impact on the time frame for processing of the bearing in mind that we would like to process the financing bill for the right House. That's
capture Kochi's referring to process and the effect of our proceeding with this would have on the time frame, which I understand the political part is not an issue because you put in the request now, which means as the process begins, the answer is yes and it doesn't affect the time frame. Makes sense, it won't affect the time frame if you do it expeditiously. But just to clarify, also on the page 12, there's a pretty interesting bridge impact in 3 years. Here, it's only if you were away for 2 months that it applies, and then you need permission of the minister, and then you've got to do this and that. So there's a complete administrative provision applying to the acting CEOs for the councillors which now, this is for the HSRC. So the acting CEO for the HSRC is different to the CSIR, which is different to whatever we're dealing with now. They all seem to be different, which is a bit strange, I would have thought, in the harmonisation process, unless there's good reasons for it. Maybe there are very good reasons, and then it's a non-issue. But I'm just saying, if there's no good issue, it seems to me we should harmonize it. It seems rational.
Thanks, Chair, and honourable members. I think what Honourable Smith is raising is correct, but I just want to indicate that when we considered some of the amendments that we wanted to bring to Parliament, we looked at the areas of this where we wanted to improve and try and harmonize in relation to the key areas of the bill, which was, one, the appointment of the boards, two, the appointment of CEOs. We never went to some of the specific areas that I think Honourable Smith is raising, because we did not, in other words, they were not creating any administrative inefficiencies in our, in our view. But I think if, for example, we were looking at all the principal acts from, you know, in totality, we probably would pick up this issue and say, how do we then address it? But I think because the approach that we took in dealing with this amendment bill was not a total revamp of all our legislation. You know, we were looking at those specific areas that we often view that they currently create some challenges in terms of administering some of the legislation. But the point that is being raised is quite correct. I'm even of the view that probably in future we probably need to revisit all the principal acts and actually amend them separately, as, you know, each individual principal act we dealt with to ensure that we create that mapping out, mapping exercise to pick up those inaccuracies and misalignments in a sense. So I think I would like to announce the committee that I think for the purposes of dealing with this bill, that we probably note that some of this, which as I said, I don't know that they are correct, but I think try and act the committee to try and zoom in into those areas that we brought before the committee without really neglecting the point that Honourable Smith raised, because I think it's quite correct that we normalize and harmonize the usage of language. Because I think with the CSIR, there's a lot more specifics to say, now, for example, if you appoint a CEO, these are the things that you might consider. In other areas, it's just really limited. So I think that's a point, I think, for me. If we had probably sufficient time, Honourable Chair, I would even say that we could actually go and amend to ensure that we take that into consideration. Because I think it is a specific point, but it does not really, in other words, negatively impact on the process of this thing in a sense, particularly on the areas that we wanted to improve. That's
part of the list.
I'm going to ask a ridiculous question, but why don't we do it properly once and for all? Why should we then later on come back and do the same exercise on other matters? Do we have the power of the committee to send them back and say, align all the original or what the principal act? Why don't we do it properly once and for all? That's what I would like to suggest, Chair. Thank you.
Yeah, the committee has actually given all the right to do that. Now, actually, the committee can even say that we don't want this issue. So, one of the things that we raised
think the point is well taken. You're quite correct. We have to probably do the harmonization across the board in all our legislation rather than, but I think the current harmonization that we're dealing with specifically obviously refers to the areas, the two areas that we wanted to highlight, and I think the issue of SACNAS, which I think for us is key, particularly in relation to the reconstitution of the board that is imminent. So it would probably, if the committee would allow, that the sections that we have identified, which requires harmonization and obviously introduction of the insertion of the new sections relating to the dissolution and so forth, that if those could be processed with an understanding that all the principal acts of the government or entities should at least within the next 2 years be dealt with in full. In other words, that the department initiates the process immediately after this bill has passed to start the process of ensuring that all our basic governing our entities are brought back to Parliament with this clear cleanup, that taking into consideration what the Laws Amendment would have approved and obviously the standardization of different sections. So I think if the committee would allow that, we would really appreciate that.
Yeah, I think that is a reasonable request. As long as that second part, the caveat, is adhered to. In other words, we accept there's a two-year process by which these bills will be passed, which means they come to us, the process starts, we need regular reports, we put it in our annual report, we put it in our everything that is a legislative program initiated, henceforth. If we put all that on the record, then I'm happy to accept that. Because I think we have to be reasonable. If we don't do that, then we're effecting piecemeal changes anyway, which is not going to be a good thing. So, to me, it's a rational approach. I hope you're quite happy to accept it.
Do you
have
me? I think you should have done a proper job initially, because this last page of yesterday is an indication as to the fact that it was a bit of a sloppy job. So I'm going to be very blunt. Right through the process, starting yesterday morning, we picked up a few things that indicated to us that it was not a properly done job. You referred to a specific board that has to be, if I understand you correctly, in due course has to be appointed. You refer to a certain board. Which one is it? Is this process going to create so many problems that is it possible to appoint the board? Because I stand with my suggestion that we should send the department back to do a proper job and align all the principal acts. Thank you.
Thank you.
another tricky situation, almost like the example now of the heading, where it was changed and another actor would just act as conflicted. So even if something is deleted, the principal act will merely show deleted by the amendment or amendment act of the state for clarity purposes. Thank you, Chairperson. So you must A, amending a cabinet sign of the legislator. If they're dealing with the disqualification and the vacation of office in the setting of vacancy, so similar to what has been previously proposed, the consultation process with the council is there, the minister is the appointing authority, and then to bring Parliament into the role as a check and oversight once again, Chair. It's just a proposal that there must be a report of any decision taken in terms of the decision to Parliament within 15 days, and then also seeking to the compliance requirements.
Just out of interest, 471, it deals with the issue we discussed earlier.
Yes.
71. Yeah. It may or may not cover us, of course, but at least there's a wording which kind of deals with the problem.
Yeah.
Just to say, Chair, just for clarity, in sub 5 at the bottom, not the new 5, the original 5. If the office of a member of the council becomes vacant before expiration of the term, the minister must appoint a person nominated by the council. That sounds to me, just going back to the comments the minister advised made earlier about the discretion of the minister to reject or report or not accept somebody, there seems to be a clear case that the minister has no discretion to reject somebody who has been nominated and therefore has to appoint. Just clarity there.
I think this was explained yesterday in terms of the specific nature of the assembly.
Yes, it's representative structure.
It's a representative structure.
Thank you, Chair. Then moving on to Clause 9, speaks to the amending the National Scientific Professions Act, and speaks to the composition of the Council of the Central Bank Act. There is an amendment that was proposed yesterday. In taking out the confusion regarding professional natural sciences and certified natural sciences, to bring the clause in line with the rationale and presented with the service line and then presented by the department, could mean to say must be sciences. So that reflects the committee decision, or the committee that I'm proposing there then. And similarly, we are proposing that there be a reporting mechanism for responsibility and set it as a substitution. Clause 10 then speaks to the nomination process, and that calls for appointments to the panel, the minister is the appointing authority here, and then similarly we are proposing then a similar amendment to the reporting function, so that same standard throughout the reporting, the reporting of the reporting decision. Next members have any questions? I'm going to need to put in certain sections.
It's not the amendment. I just think any of the issues we discussed yesterday of the nature of the problem. If you look at clause 5, if the minister receives no nominations or an insufficient number of nominations within this period specified, the minister may, after consultation of the panel, appoint the required number of persons to qualify. That was a very important provision dealing with the issue that was raised if there are insufficient nominees received from the public process. I just wanted to check that provision covers all of those. Presumably, if it was considered important yesterday for the board we were discussing, it would be equally important for all boards.
Chair, what we agreed to earlier on in relation to this process was that the minister. I'm continuing with the feeling of fighting this process here. Perhaps it's something that we may have to insert, because with other provisions it refers to the minister exercising this power in a transparent manner, without explaining as to how, because there may be various ways of getting later that in doing that he may have to consult the title who initially provided.
I'm referring now to the original act, the first line, invite the public by notice in the Gazette and in at least one leading newspaper. My comment regarding the language is again applied to the monsters. Are you going to?
The harmonization there doesn't only refer to language. In the other, for the other boards, it's two newspapers circulated nationally. Here's one newspaper per province. Now, I presume there's a rationale for not amending this to be consistent with the rest. And this falls within the ambit of this bill, namely dealing with the nomination of board members. So it's not as if this is outside the scope of what you're seeking to achieve. You've chosen not to amend that specifically as a deliberate act. We want it to be like this as opposed to the others, which are two newspapers nationally. Could we get clarity on why there would be a different process for this particular board?
I don't think there were specific reasons. I think in relation to the SACNAS, I think the view is that you have a number of, what I would say additional, but I think trying to attract the spreads in terms of geographic representation. But I think there's no specific really, because I think the national newspapers, I guess, are also circulated in various provinces. So I think this is one area where we could harmonize it to use the same language in relation to two national newspapers for this particular process. So I think we're more than happy to amend it.
Okay, just to add, the member was not here when I made the remark that you referred yesterday to the fact that you didn't get proper response from the public on your advertisement. And that's the other reason why we are emphasizing this issue.
Yeah. So that's also why clause five is important. So if the nominations process fails, then this is providing the minister can then make a nomination. So and if the nominations process for one particular board can fail, it could simply fail for any board. Therefore, you would want a similar provision for all boards. So I think the Brian agreed to.
That is still within the bill before us, so we can do those amendments after that meeting.
Yes.
Thank you, Chair. And then to the agency of the Church of Office of Members of the Council, there it's similarly just a supervisor for reporting a responsibility on the minister to the National Assembly. And further, if he kept implementing the department is proposing as to how this process should run.
I missed one on the previous one. It begins on the top of the page 7, the old 7. But in any case, it is clause 10 to B. Also appoint an independent panel. Thank you, Chief.
You are not here, but you are correct with that.
it's only in the subsection 4 of the proposed amendment that the consultation of the council is taken out. And so this one, it's just being the action of the minister and the council is there, the dynamics have shifted, and then for the process again, the formal functions of parliament highlights.
Just out of curiosity, you'll see at the top of page 9 that provision is made there that a member of a board can be removed if a person who said is no longer considered fit and proper. That provision, therefore, obviously, is a qualification for membership as a total member.
On page 9?
Yeah, at the top.
Close 12 goes to page 8 and 9. Close 12,
page 9, it's just easier to reference the page number sometimes. Yeah, so here, by implication, the qualification to be a board member must be that you're fit and proper. Otherwise you can't be disqualified by not being fit and proper. So that's quite an interesting provision considering the discussion we had earlier. Maybe we should extend this somewhere else. I mean, are we saying all board members have to be fit and proper? Because you are here.
The discussion we had earlier was in relation to the chief executive board.
Correct. Correct. And then we said it doesn't apply to the board members. Mm-hmm. And now here we say board members have to be fit and proper. And I'm dropping the skilled and qualified. And I'm talking about fit and proper for board members. For this particular board, you're saying a member must be fit and proper. But we don't say it elsewhere. If we're harmonizing candidature for boards, presumably they should all be fit and proper, or none of them need to be fit and proper. You can't have one board have to be fit and proper and not another one, surely.
I think
to respond to that. I think Honourable Smith will appreciate that most of these principal acts were written at different times. So therefore some expansions would emphasize the principal acts, and then when a new act is written, I think it's like copy and paste of a particular act. But I think the point that is raising is correct, that any board who's a board member should be a person who's fit and proper to hold office. I think what that means, can be interpreted in a different way, whether somebody is sane or somebody is fit and proper in terms of whether they're not under any sequestration or administration and all those matters related to them. But again, it goes back to the point that I raised earlier on around the substantive overhaul of the principal acts, which I think would have to be undertaken to ensure that I think we keep due attention to these matters.
I don't know whether we're already here, but we have done to this point very thoroughly in terms of the board members, the board members as a CEO, as qualified and suitable and qualified, and then in relation to fit and proper. So there was a good explanation that was given here why board members cannot describe in terms of fit and proper or something like that. And so there's another problem when you come back because then you are overtaken by events. Now, that's why I say they are caught, because the explanation they gave now totally differs from what is now here.
I think the discussion earlier was that a CEO need not be fit and proper. It was persons who hold a kind of office, board members, public prosecution, that kind of thing, requires fit and proper. The issue of whether a board member had to be fit and proper wasn't discussed earlier because it wasn't in the bill. But here it is in the bill by reverse, in reverse, because if you're not fit and proper, you have to let it go. Therefore, constitutional boards and the process by which you appoint them. This is not a peripheral matter, like whether whatever the other issues might be peripheral. This is core to what you're trying to achieve in the harmonization process. So either you remove it here, so nobody has to be fit and proper, or you make all of them fit and proper. To me, it can't be.
So what is the response from Mr. Palmer?
Chair, I think I've used that reduction in sentence for all of this. So we'll have, I think after this meeting, move on that particular point into all the sections relating to the members of the board.
I thought I was going to say that it's not in the principal bill, or you're not saying
it's in the bill. Yes, I mean, it's analogous to the position we discussed earlier, amending section 4. But I don't know, procedurally I would say tough up the parliament. I mean, that rule is just nonsensical. We've never heard it. And no committee I've been in that I'm aware of ever bothered to apply it. So maybe they're being strictly modest now. But I would say that this is core to this bill, therefore we should do it. And if that requires telling parliament for doing it, then so be it.
You're right, this is the core of the purpose of the amendment, so those filters have already been opened. When it comes to the appointment of the board chair, it should be quite easy to put that in as a requirement.
Oh, that not going to the process.
Okay, yeah, so the filters are open. They're on the table.
Have we done with this one?
No.
On the same page 9, 4A, and this is the third one after your subsection 1, appoint a person from the list, 4A, which is page 12, section 4A on page 9. If a member, yes. I can read the whole bit, but it's then first, if a member of the council dies or vacates his or her office before the expiration of his or her term of office, the minister may appoint a person. I know it's the principal act who meets the requirements for appointment in the relevant category in terms of section 3. I just want to get clarity on this, from which list or and do we need to re-advertise or advertise after how many years? A person can die a few months before the expiry term.
This is earlier from the school system.
Thanks, Chair. We earlier on we agreed that we would make return to the shelf list in all cases where the minister makes that decision.
But you mean that it's now the principal act, you're going to change the principal act? Because the wording comes from the principal.
Sorry, Chair. I think I
can
some confusion. The black part of the principal act means I didn't mean to over caution. Those are open. That section, that whole section. If the clause, but here clause 12 refers to section 6, the section 6 is open to you to redraft completely if you want to. But for instance, in the first one, in your Scientific Research Council Act, the first clause that's there open is section 7. So sections 1 to 6 in the Scientific Research Council Act is not on the table at the moment, so for that you'll have to ask permission to bring those to the table. But if a clause references the section, that section is completely open. You can rewrite the whole section if you want to. I've heard the department about that, but you can rewrite the whole section. Thank you.
Thank you.
Honourable Mr. Jefferson, is the Unified Research Council Act, which is amended clause 156 to section 5 of that Act, the Board of Council, the Board of Council. And that is also an example of where Parliament legislates to design recommendation authority is being taken away, and we are then proposing that that be substituted with a reporting function at the end. Well, by medical fee, there I did propose deletion of subsection 7B, because that in a limited extent echoes the reporting option that is being proposed, where it says the Minister must report the National Assembly of his or her decision, but that decision was limited to that section. Subsection means that we're proposing it being taken out to speak to the whole session, so it's just a subsection. Then,
the department has taken out the promotion. Okay, just stop 1 second. Does anybody understand a word of what's just been said? Did you understand what's happening then? I was completely lost, sorry. What got deleted? Section 7B got deleted, it's not here, I can't see it or whatever. Am I missing something?
There's no 7B that's been deleted.
The panel, issue on the panel, and the two national newspapers, the languages, and being on 3C. It's the first time that reference is made to the curriculum vitae. Shouldn't we also harmonize it when it comes to the other boards? Because that's the first time I've picked up curriculum vitae. So,
Chair, we can delete it from after shortlist and put a full stop of the shortlist of candidates and not get addressed to the last time to the colonel of the something like that.
But
it's
not
a good
thing.
Okay.
Yeah.
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 Sorry, I was busy reading things earlier, and that's why I dragged behind. Just to remind the members, page 10, 6D has to go out because it's been reviewed in terms of the clause we had earlier. And then, if I may, 7A on page 11, the minister may, after consultation, remove a member on reasonable grounds. But of course, elsewhere we talk about fit and proper. We also talk about whether certain things happen to remove them. That's not consistent. Elsewhere. On clause 9, it says if a member of the board ceases to hold office, elsewhere we say if a member vacates office. I don't know if it's exactly the same thing or not, but it was partly the discussion in the beginning we had about vacating or ceasing, so just to alert you there. And then I want to ask a sensitive question on 12. I'm not quite sure I understand the logic here. But I think 12 says, and it's the same thing everywhere. We're all on clause 15, on the different clause 15. Yeah, I've just done 6D, that's page 10, 7A, 9, and now I'm on 12. raising 4 points, yes. Okay, so now I'm not the daughter of this time. Okay, so Chair, on 12, on the section 12, yeah, it's proposed, right, which is throughout the standard, so I just want to get clarity. What happens is we have a nomination process, right? There are not enough nominations. What does then say is the minister appoints? So do we not make provision at all for re-nomination? I mean, re-publicizing. I thought the process that's being written now is you have a public advertising process and it produces a result. If it's not satisfactory, then you always have the option of re-publicizing, and only then, if it doesn't work, you might want to go the different route. Are you saying here automatically the default position would be you advertise, you don't get a good result, and minister appoints? That's why I'm just asking, is that appropriate for all instances, or is that what we want?
I think that's what we want. I mean, it's in a similar situation where we advertise for a position.
Mm.
You advertise for a position. If you don't attract suitable candidates, then you use other recruitment processes, because I think there's no guarantee that the advertisement, but also I think there are certain specific periods that you have to adhere to in terms of ensuring that within a specified period the post or the board has been reconstituted. So I think the re-advertising process really might derail that particular record, but with those questions it doesn't guarantee you success.
Okay, which is the first as well. I understand. So if for example we have an advertising process and it yields a certain number of candidates and it's not considered suitable, right, then we say the minister may appoint. Have we not qualified the fact how the minister appoints anybody? Does he, open his telephone directory and throw darts at them? Or what does he do to find candidates? Because he's advertised, and now he disappoints. Somebody did say he has to appoint. Have we not circumscribed anything in terms, prescribed, should I say, anything in terms of what happens? He just, at that advertising program, the minister appoints. What? Appoints who?
Yesterday, Honourable Clopas Lawrence asked that question, and the answer that I gave was that we had indicated that the process that the minister uses to be transparent,
yeah.
And I made an example obviously minister would have to either request specific organizations, for example, to provide nominations directly, from the such organization. For example, if we were in a body where it is NGT kind of would ask SAFA, for example, so really for me I'm making those practical examples, yeah. And I even said that one of the reasons we said transparent is because the minister should there be questions around the appointment, the minister should be able to demonstrate to Parliament what transparent process has been followed, because that transparency beyond reproach, and it's upon the minister as executive to ensure that they adhere to that, and Parliament is there to ensure that the MP doesn't pull the names out of the hat.
Okay. I said that actually, it is logical. I do recall the discussion. I was just trying to think of whether that was sufficient, and I think perhaps it is. We take the trust, but maybe just a wording issue. I mean, phraseology. The words "in a transparent manner" at the end of the sentence seem to be awkward. I would have put that after the word "may." The minister may, in a transparent manner, appoint the required person. So I mean, to put it in a transparent manner there, in terms of the act, looks a bit weird to me. And I'm just wondering whether he must. I mean, when you say "may," why would he "may"? Because you have to have a board. And also, you remove "may" as in the place of the "must" in a number of instances. I would have thought here's a victory. If you have no re-advertising, you've got no board, you've got a problem, so he must avoid.
Also, I'm covering a problem to ask about the transparency. Since he has an obligation to under the law that was created to report to Parliament on the appointment, he will be able to manage the transparency of the process.
Yeah.
Assume minister he or her not find suitable qualified members. Then they say he must.
But then they say who?
That's
why I'm saying I'm calling it with me. Because we were putting him or her on the spot to say, well, if we're not going out to understand this, then he or she may feel compelled to appoint me. This will not be proper. That's why I'm saying may, because he may then have an explanation and then say, we advertise on that issue. Think one or the call is raised.
Now, is he here to appoint masters?
Yes.
And it means that we will be arriving at a situation of discharge and if the formality is not formed. Is it something new? That is why we are giving the minister this time that if he has not got the people, then he must admit it.
In the previous regulation, one of the provisions elsewhere said the board continues until its successor board is appointed. In addition to the main might suffice because there's an indeterminate period for which that board could stay in existence. But here, it ceases after 6 months extension. So I would have thought because of that, you can't have no board, you have to have a board. So it must have been a problem. I know it doesn't really matter, but it's been made this time, but it must, it does kind of put a discrimination on the team and see that.
I would go back to my comments regarding the curriculum vitae. I would like to suggest that we keep it this and harmonize the others with this one, because if the minister has to finally appoint, if I understand it correctly, it's good for him to have the curriculum vitae with him. And you also explained that he has to explain to the committee. Now, if he has all the evidence regarding the different candidates, it doesn't make sense to me that the curriculum vitae makes sense. But if somebody can convince me, it's not necessary, please do so.
No, because the minute somebody appoints does not sit down and respect for the appoints a panel to collect the pieces.
Then I understand.
This is how the minister appoints. You talk to the panel and then
The assumption is that the panel would have interrogated the curriculum. If necessary, they would have consulted the references. They would have made sure that these council members fit the certain categories that had to be filled. And they would then provide a report to the list to say, these people meet the qualifications in terms of the CV, in terms of their references, in terms of their category. It doesn't prevent the minister from calling for that original documentation. So I don't know if it adds any value by saying with the CVs. If you don't say with the CVs and references, and is the minister going to second guess the whole process of a panel? In this case, why appoint a panel?
In other words, then the response is we change the principal act here, and we stop with a shortlist. Okay, so that's in the response to my question. Thank you.
Department, and then they have proposed yesterday the inclusion of in consultation with the minister.
consultation with the minister, which is fine, I mean, that's what we want to do, that's fine. But as long as it's applied to all boards too. I'm not quite sure where the other provisions make speak to the issue of payment and remuneration allowances, but I know they do. So presumably in each instance we have to have this consultation.
But did say that some worker is disadvantaged and some worker is not yet.
Well, the issue what we're harmonising is the consultation with the ministers. The issue of the remuneration issue, which I raised earlier, which is being referred into as part of the bigger package.
The reference to the consultation with the minister, this is one of the instances where it was not in the original to ensure that it's seen throughout, we propose that it also be added so that it harmonizes properly with the others. It's also, it is now in all parts.
That's my question. Is a specific amendment in all the ones we've looked at already, is it there? Is it? The remuneration being in consultation with the minister, is it in all of them? I mean, if it is, it's fine.
I mean, consultation is. Yeah.
Consultation on remuneration.
Thank you, Chair. The Bill 18 refused with the minister's power to make regulations. That should be.
Okay, I apologize.
I'll
retract.
Chair, with the same thing in the other regarding the other entities, which we delete heads because we felt that it's a matter that needs, that the minister needs to handle administratively in the process of appointing the board, or perhaps even have an internal policy around the staggering of boards. The problem with having it in the legislation, I think the other provision which were specific, the ones that we deleted, that at least one third of the member of the chair of the member should be retained for continuing purposes. But we foresee situations where, for whatever reason, that one third cannot be retained, then it becomes a challenge, you know, in terms of compliance. So it needs to be dealt with administratively. But this one, we didn't report it, it does not specify in terms of the numbers that need to be retained, but it's consistent with the principle of affecting the staggering process of the problem and so forth.
Jefferson, I'm not sure I understand that too well. I do understand the notion of continuity. So you've got a board that starts in January, it finishes in December, there's 10 members. So the civil office all expires in December. So what happens is you've got your new board in January, you keep some of the ones from the first year to come to the second year. Right? But they all have the same term of office. You're simply extending their term. Just want to say that. It's just saying that their term of office doesn't expire at the same time, which means you've got, it's like American Senate, where the half members are appointed every 4 years. So you have actually, like, the board has half of its members appointed for 5 years, and then there's another half appointed for a different 5 years. That's what this is talking to. Is that correct? Because if it is, it's nonsense.
Yeah, I think the intention of this is to make sure there's continuity in the board.
Yes.
But the point I think is correct, is that the board is appointed for a period of 5 years. The whole board is appointed, therefore the whole term of office expires.
Yes.
Some of the members may have a reappointment, and that's the intention of continuity. But this reads as if the term of office can be staggered.
Yes.
Which is wrong. So it has to be reworded.
Just to add on that, I think this is one area that needs to be fixed. Because what happens is that if chair was a call, is that most instances when there's a vacancy in the board, the member that is appointed to fill the vacancy is for the remaining period, unexpired period of the term of office. I think the intention here was to say if there's a vacancy, you then appoint somebody on the in their 5 year term, then it becomes staggered,
yes,
in a sense. But that's not the practice. The practice is to say that. So again, the point I raised earlier about some of these legislation that was reaching at this point, which I think it becomes critical. But in this instance, we could change it because it's part, I think it's part and parcel. And the legal advisors will advise us against that, but I'll take an advice, but my view is that it's something that could be changed.
Chair, I think we can delete the first subsection.
If we try to reword it, we have to then say the minister should strive to ensure continuity of membership. I don't quite know how to do it, how to phrase it, but the legal impact has come up with something. But it's difficult to it'd be very difficult to pin the minister down to insist on continuity if all the members resign. Or for whatever reason they don't want to continue, then you're going to have a discontinuous board. And there's nothing you can do about it. So if that's tied into legislation, if you must have a continuous board, then it becomes impossible. So let me strive to achieve continuity in membership. Something like that.
there again is the example of the removal of the recommending authority of the National Assembly, and then the proposed replacement of the reporting function on the concerns from science of the requirements. Isn't that maybe some specific questions on that? So, and that thing will also assist with the department's inclusion of the fact that decisions be taken in a transparent manner.
Does not contain suitable persons or required number of suitable persons, the minister may appoint the required number of persons who qualify to be appointed in terms of it. So what exactly is the process then? He may appoint from what? From the list? Advertisement for being in 6 May? And I would like to know, are we going to change the wording there as well, and how are we going to change it?
Chair, my understanding was that we're going to change it to read like this. If the short list compiled in terms of subsection 2 does not contain suitable persons or the required number of suitable persons, the minister will still have to probably discuss with it about the May and March, that either May or March in a transparent manner appoint the required number of persons of qualified to be appointed in terms of the site.
In a transparent manner?
Yeah.
Go
ahead.
Thank you, Chair. Then, Clause 25, due to disqualification, removal from office, set of office, and filling the vacancy. There is just some second amendment that's important to vote. The good chair is now held to dealing with it.
Just a quick one. That chapter 8.3, the decision to remove a member of the board being done by an independent on basis of recommendation, I haven't seen that elsewhere. Just curious. Because we do make provision elsewhere for members to lose their membership through all sorts of things. But
but it just seems to be Minister Bukhtimati is unhappy. Here there's an independent board. Should we not standardize that? And then secondly, the same thing with sub 7 there. If a member of the board dies, resigns, or is removed, the minister must appoint a person for the remaining period. It's obvious thing, I mean, I'm sure it's exactly what happens elsewhere, but there's a say so elsewhere. I know we do, but I just haven't seen the wording just now.
Thank you.
I'm just asking whether we've got that provision for all the other boards. I'm assuming so. If not, I'm assuming it should be there. Maybe it is there, that's fine, no problem.
Yes, the intention is that we clear that the person appointed to fill vacancies would be the appointment of the for the remaining period. We will check, and if it's by any chance not in the provision, but as far as we think it is, it others in terms of which one is not here.
I hear what it says. But on 8.3, when it says the removal from the board by the minister on the committee of the panel, as against the alien provision, that says you are now serving as the chair of the minister. If then there is a disagreement between me and the minister, may dissolve the board. Or to this decision. To hear that. That's what I'm saying. I'm begging this pardon. Then he said, we've been going to apply across.
Chair, my response was in relation to statutes in fairness, which talks about the replacement of the members that have assigned them to be for an expired term of the member that they
have. My question was also in sub 3 there. Yeah. I asked how are you harmonizing by removing this or adding it elsewhere? Neither.
Yes, with the decision of the appointment of an independent panel by the minister. The minister will base his decision on the recommendation of an independent panel appointed by him. Chair, the reference to an independent panel is somehow it only appears in this act. It does not appear in the other act, and perhaps for purposes of harmonization we may have to not make a reference to the constitution of the panel for purposes of the committee to remove members of the board.
So, do I understand you mean to say you might over it to come back to this standardization? Because the whole issue which underlines my colleague's point, which actually raised as well, is that we are trying to harmonize. And that harmonization, are you going to come back to us with this position?
They are supposed to. All the other corrections are doing, they are supposed to bring them back to the corrections. And so to confirm to you, Honorable Commissioner Kenyana, we will standardize it. by using the phrasing that is in other legislation, which does not make reference to the appointment of the member of the independent panel.
Okay.
Okay.
Any other
next tool can be a tool to take with you again, which is a resolution of the board, requiring similar and graphic as highlighted before. And then the final tool in the amendment tool is tool 27, dealing with the chief executive officer of the IWC and the board appointment of that individual in the office in consultation with the minister, being the last proposal from the department, and then just with the technical amendment.
Having the committee that they are proposing that subsection 11 of that section be used as a reference made to two consecutive terms of chief and executive officer. You know, Chair, listening earlier to the discussion we had, well, really the discussion we had earlier, that these are the urgent amendments that go through quickly now, and we have this 2-year period to, you know, read that principle act. I'm happy with that in principle, but I do think that it should be a relatively easy task to harmonise the CEO clauses here. I mean, each of these bodies has a CEO, and the provisions dealing with their appointment, their conditions, are all phrased differently. Some of them have a common 2-month period before something happens, others have no common period, sometimes they require one qualification or another. If they're going to come back to us anyway, not possible today, we're having another process, and it won't be before next week, because we only get to meet next week, I trust. Now then, I think they've got enough time to redraft the CEO provisions as well, to standardise them. It shouldn't be too complicated. We've then covered the executive and the boards, as opposed to merely the information process. So I'd like to recommend that.
Thanks, Chair. Honourable Smith, from our side, it's something that we can be able to deal with together with the parliamentary process, provided that it doesn't conflict with the rules of parliament, and that is an advice that the parliamentary process can provide.
Any other
We're going to have a substantive discussion on the issue of four options. I don't know at lunchtime now, I'm not quite sure what we have in mind. I said we were going to have a substantive discussion on the issue of the four options. We were parking the four options until we had done these other amendments, but it's now 10 past 1. I know. So we're going to do it now. Well, Chair, I mean, the four options.